This is a topic-based podcast, so each episode we're going to tackle a different issue facing board games, the people who play them, and their industry. Our topic for today? Well, we're going to investigate how much game you can pack into a small box. Hello.
Hello again.
Hello, welcome to Tabletop Inquisition. We've made it to another episode.
Yay. Episode 6, is it?
We're such grown-ups. Correctly.
I know, it's amazing.
I know, right? Thank you.
Still going.
Thank you if you've still been here since episode 1. You get some sort of badge of honor for sticking with us this far.
You get a special badge.
So how have things been with you, Oliver? What's you been up to lately?
Well, I've been, usual stuff, obviously, working on the blog, the usual stuff there. Still trying to write articles on a Tuesday. They're more topic related. I don't know whether people do follow my blog. If you don't, please do. There's links in the description of this podcast. I'm always trying to think of some subjects, and sometimes I seem to hit the nail on the head, and sometimes it is not quite so interesting. But the last one I've written is about games for, at least 3-4 players, bigger groups and things like that, which I think is a topic that doesn't really get covered very much. People like to talk about, people like to talk about solo games, but I don't think they do actually that much. That's the other thing. It seems to be a bit... Ooh. Undercovered. I mean, more and more games do have solo options now, but it's still, I think, actually not talked about a lot. And then two-player, again, seems to be getting more and more popular. But when you then come to 3 and 4 players, obviously you get lots of games that way. But when you then go into higher player counts, 5, 6, 7, and things like that, I think it's another whole different ball game. And I just thought I'd talk about those sort of things.
That's really cool. I find your blog really insightful. I like that you raise these kinds of questions. And it's funny, because nobody ever talks really about games for 3, 4, and 5 players involved. Yeah. Like, I have a special shelf just with games that you can play with people beyond 2, because I mostly play with 2.
Yeah.
And it's a tough one, isn't it, when you have a group of people around trying to find something that works with everybody and also goes to those bigger player counts really well. I think it's really important. It's something we don't talk about a whole lot, isn't it?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, as I say, I'm trying to, it's one of those things, I'm trying to follow Twitter conversations and things like that. And sometimes there's some inspiration it's quite fun to write about these things. And, having looked at, I have never played solo games myself before, but, play with my wife, 2-player games quite regularly. And then obviously games groups, we have then, four of us in total. And that works as well. But again, that's a different type of game. And going from 2 to, say, 3 or 4 players is actually quite a big step. And then going higher player counts changes dynamics even further. So it's quite interesting how that shifts the gameplay.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely like a little piece that people don't, I suppose, discuss like on purpose. The kind of way people talk about party games, they go to big player counts and solo games and sometimes a game for 2 players. But generally speaking, that little bit in the middle where you have to deal with a bunch of people is something that I suppose we should probably think about more. Yeah. You don't have lists of games for 5 players.
That's right.
You see lists for solo games, but not for 5 players. But that's really cool. I like that you brought that stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. How about you then? What have you been up to? You've been quite busy filming and all sorts of things I can see. I love watching your videos and commenting on them and trying to keep the conversation going there as well.
Oh, you're far too kind with all your comments. You're like my number one supporter. So thank you so much.
Right.
No, I've been making plenty of videos. I've been having a really hard time finding a way to review games that I just bought myself and was playing at home that weren't games sent to me to review specifically. So because I put out a video once a week and I put out an unboxing video to go with it, but that's just for fun. And I wanted to find something where I could just literally sit down and go, I'm trying this game out, I really like it, I think you should know about it, but here's not my full review, because that takes time and effort. So I've put it together what I'm calling the an introduction series, where I just sit down and I have a chat about the game, and I cover some of the topics actually that people said they wanted to know about on Twitter. This is the first time I've had a bunch of kind of input from people, so I got kind of new sections and things to talk about. It's crazy nerve-wracking because I don't have a script. So I did it all in one take. Now, not that I have problems talking, but trying to keep everything on point and focused is kind of a hard job.
You've done really well.
On top of that, I've been watching TV.
I think you've done really well. Certainly, I mean, you've changed your setup now as well. So you're sitting on the armchair, which is amazing. I think it looks really cool. And then, as I say, this video now, we're just talking about the game, and I think it works really well. It's you know, as you say, it is a bit difficult just to talk off the cuff. You know, even with the podcast, I think we're practicing this, aren't we? So yeah, no, I think you're doing really well.
Yes, we prepare. Yeah. Oh, thank you. So yeah, that's kind of what we've been up to. I love how it's all in. None of it says we were playing board games. No, we were creating content.
Well, that's what we do, isn't it?
I guess that's what we're supposed to do.
I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, speaking about playing board games, then I think that leads nicely onto our next section of the games we did play. So.
Yay.
Do you want to make a start with what you have been playing?
Sure, why not? I'm sure. I like talking about games. So there's no question here. Because I sat down to think about what games I'd be playing this month, and I had to refer to the. I have a stats app on my phone. Do you ever use those kind of things to track your games?
I don't. I used to have a spreadsheet, like a Google sheet, and record our games nights and things. But it's, I don't know, it's a lot of effort, and I've given up on that. And just enjoy playing them now.
I'm a big fan of the app for the phone, because I always fill in what games we've played and kind of the scores and stuff like that, and I find it really handy to know what games I've actually been playing, or I can look back to the different plays and find out who really won last time. Yep. Those kind of things I quite like it a lot. I'm kind of religious about it. So the first thing I did when I figured out I was like, what games did we play, I had to go and look at my app. So the first game that's kind of on my radar and I haven't shut up about for the entire month is Die Tavernen im Tiefental. Am I pronouncing that right?
You're pronouncing it very well. I'm really impressed. Yay. I think you're probably one of the few reviewers and YouTubers who actually do pronounce it correctly.
Oh, I love that compliment. You know how I feel about German.
You do really well, definitely. Top marks.
That's good. So I think it means Taverns of the Deep Valley, something like that.
Yeah,
well,
apparently, Tiefental is actually a place name as well. So it's the name of a town or something. Ooh. So yes, you're right. It would technically translate as the Deep Valley. But I think it's also, because of the place that's called that. So I don't know what the actual history is.
Thank you for the insider information.
That's right.
That's fantastic. So this is the new hotness in my house, and it's by Wolfgang Warsch, who you might know has published The Mind, which we both love, and The Quacks of Quedlinburg. He's really on a roll this past year. He's just putting out amazing game after amazing game. And when I saw this game about running your own tavern, I was sold. I didn't even know how the game played or what was in the box. I was like, this one, please. And it is a super fun deck building dice drafting game, and you have your own little bar, and you're trying to kind of upgrade your bar and get your patrons to come and visit you, and then whoever has the most points wins as it goes. But it's really simple but really clever, and I love the fact that you have your own little bar. And the best thing about the entire game is everybody has a little beer mat to put their dice and when you roll your dice, you put them on your beer mat and you pick one, and then you pass them to your opponent. Each little beer mat has like little scribblings on it. So there's one with someone playing hangman, there's one with someone playing X's and O's, and there's one with a stain. I just think the components of the game are just so cute. Someone put a ton of effort into it. I've been having so much fun playing with it. It's also the first game I've ever bought that was in another language, so, so that's good side. I wonder when it'll come to English, hopefully someday soon, but thank God for Board Game Geek and people who bother translating rules for people like me.
I was gonna say,
So that's been the real kind of star of the month. And then the second game we'll talk about before I take up like an entire segment is one that came from Kickstarter. So I don't often get things from Kickstarter, so it was super exciting. I was like, oh, there's a game in my house. I can't even remember when we ordered this. So this is Space Explorers, and it comes from 25th Century Games. Some people may remember it because it's got this really cool retro art. And the reason we picked it actually is the game designer is the same guy who made a game called Viceroy, and that's a game that people don't talk about a lot, but it's super, super good. You draft tiles to build like a pyramid of tableau building. I'm terrible at it, but my husband loves it. I don't think he's ever lost. But when we saw that he was making this other game, Space Explorers, we had to get involved. And it's very much like a Splendor game. Basically, you're recruiting people into your tableau with matching symbols and so that you can complete space projects.
Okay.
And it sounds really simple, and it probably is, but it's got a couple of little twists in it that make it really stand out. So I've been really, really impressed with it because I don't really like games like Splendor where, you know, you buy the thing to get the thing to buy the thing to get the thing. But this one really just kind of, it just takes it up a notch, just a little bit, enough to make it a bit different. So that's mainly what I've been playing this month. It's been super exciting. What about yourself?
Yeah, what I have been doing. I mean, I haven't played anything new. I mean, I've got a few things Kickstarter that hopefully arrive very soon. We'll see. But in the meantime, we're playing the classic. So my wife and I have gone back to playing Wingspan again and really enjoying that. You know, two-player. It's one of those games. You know, you play it all the time. And it's quite fascinating how, having played it so many times, how the different cards actually affect the sort of outcome as well. And I think we're sort of scores wise, we're probably always quite close as well. You know, I don't think there's anyone who wins more than the other. But yeah, it's quite interesting how, you know, depending on what birds come out, how different the final scores are. So that the end scoring varies, can vary quite a bit. And yeah, I quite like that you're sort of starting to explore the sort of different, you know, because you've got 140 different, 150 different birds in that. It's just crazy. You know, it's only when you play it that many times that you sort of discover the different combinations and things, and you know, you get your favorite birds after a while as well. So yeah, I'm really enjoying that, and it's just such a beautiful game. I mean, the you know, presentation of it all, the quality of the components and everything, and the gameplay is so straightforward. It's just absolutely perfect. So yeah, I've been enjoying that with my wife. And then
excellent.
With my games group, we've gone back into Terra Mystica. And I think, I don't know whether we had the discussion before, but Terra Mystica to me was a game that, yeah, because of the theme, it just doesn't work for me. You know, if I ignore the theme, I just see it as an abstract game, absolutely fine. But in my head, I just have to do that constant switch and go, right, okay, I'm not worried about terraforming or, you know, the cult track and whatever else. I just need to think, okay, I need to, you know, put this thing here to give me points there, and move up this thing, which then gives me energy, or, you know, the sort of magic thing and all that. But yes, you can ignore the theme, just look at it, you know, as more of an abstract game. And yeah, we've been playing it three players now quite a few times. Been playing it online on Yakata as well with a few friends of mine. And yeah, really enjoying it now, starting to get used to different factions or different races and exploring those. Because again, it's one of those games that, you know, if you play it only a few times, you don't really explore it fully. But now with the online gaming and the games night, I think we get through quite a few games now, which is great. So you start to explore different factions and, you know, how to play them differently and how they work and all that. So that was really good. Really enjoyed that. And then one more thing, just to round off the evening, what we've been doing is, you know, play The Mind again. You know, so we've free player. And it's, again, it's just you get the deck out and you think, yeah, well, it's going to be boring. And then, you know, so often you just have these cards so close, no one can talk. We just look at each other and suddenly we're playing, you know, these three, four, five cards in a row correctly. You know, they're all close together and you're just laughing and, you know, can't believe how it works. So yeah, that's still a favorite and it's still a lovely, you know, quick little filler game. So really enjoy that.
Hey, you have excellent choice in games.
Thank you. Yeah, so Terra Mystica is a bit of a surprise, I suppose. As I say, we thought we'd never play it again after we played originally, I don't know, quite a few years ago when a friend of mine bought it originally and he loves it. And then, you know, me and another friend just didn't get on with it for various reasons. And then, you know, started playing it again now. And you just have to sort of step back and overcome your the things you don't like about it and see it more for the mechanisms. And it is, as I say, if it's an abstract game, it's a really good game. There's some things you have to sort of cater for. I think that's how we played with the variable victory points to start with, so different factions get more points at the beginning or less points, and then also variable turn order. And I think then it works really well, and you know, we ended up having quite close points in all the games we've been playing, so it you know, it really works.
That's really, really good. Awesome. Actually, there's one more game I did play this month that I'd love to bring up, because it is the most fun. Have you ever played Wits and Wagers?
I heard about it but never played it. No.
This is from North Star Games, and it is like what I call the ultimate party game or the ultimate icebreaker. If somebody comes to the house and they've never played games before, and that did happen, this is the first thing I take out. And what it basically is a trivia game with impossible answers. So the idea is it'll ask you, you know, what year was the first email sent?
Okay.
And everyone goes, no one really knows the answer. But what you do is you make a guess and then you bet on who you think has the best answer. or who is the the closest to the real answer. So you have this entire pile of impossible questions and everyone just trying to guess and sort it out. And then, so even if you're doing terribly and you've no clue what's going on, you can bet on somebody else going, I bet he knows the answer to that, and guess their way around it. And it is just so much fun. I wish I'd it's a kind of a game you need a couple of people for, so I don't get to play it as often as I would like. But the minute I have a group here or new players, that's the one I pull out, and I always have so much fun with it. Yeah. Everybody falls around laughing. So I have, I should throw that in at the end. Good old Wits and Wagers.
Right, writing it down now. Wits and Wagers.
Wits and Wagers. Like, it reminds, you get the kind of same kind of vibe as you get with the mind, because it's almost like you're collectively trying to get the right answer, because you can bet on everyone else's answer. So you get that real feeling of, oh my god, you got it right, you know, or you were so close. It's really nice like that. It's really, really fun. So yeah, more people should come to my house so I can play more Wits and Wagers.
Right, here's the invitation. Email to email to Antoinette below, so sort it out.
Yeah. My address is
okay, cool.
It's fantastic. Oh, will we move on to the next portion?
I was gonna say that wraps up this section, and we're moving on to game terminology. So yeah, moving on to game terminology. We've got another three terms, which you people who've listened to this will obviously have read in the description already, so they know what's coming up.
Yes.
But always like this selection of terms. I think it's nice, because sometimes we don't even know what they mean really until we read the definition.
Shh, don't let them know.
Well, you know, but...
We know everything about board games all of the time. Don't doubt yourself.
That's true. Okay, fine. Let's go with that. We're the experts.
Yeah, we're very good at this.
So for those people who might have forgotten, we're going to have three terms, and both Antoinette and I will basically describe what we think what that term means, and then we're going to read out the Board Game Geek definition, and then sort of discuss what we think of that, and maybe even describe some games that fall into that category.
Oh yes.
So today we're starting with dexterity games.
Yay.
Antoinette, what is your definition of dexterity games?
Ah, interesting. Okay, so my definition of dexterity games. All right, here we go. I wrote this sentence while thinking deeply. So a game which tests your physical skills to determine the victor. And then my examples were by like flicking things or stacking things. And then I ran out of ideas, but I got that far. But I do have some really, really good examples, I think, of dexterity games, because I seem to have a desire for many of them, but don't own that many.
Okay.
So my first example actually is going to be one I reviewed, and this is Flick Fleet from Eurodice Games. And that's a really cool game where you get to flick around tiny ships on the big board. And it's a much bigger game than I think you'd think a dexterity game might be. Normally when you think about them, you think about things like maybe Meeple Circus, where you stack meeples and stuff on top of each other, or Ice Cool, where you flick penguins around the little map.
Yeah.
And then there's things like Junk Art, where you stack wooden pieces on top of each other and make pieces of art, which is also really cool. And there's also Flip Ships. This I do own, and I'm a big fan of it, where you have to flip a pog-shaped ship around and take down enemy and alien invaders, or try and hit the mothership. That's really, really fun. So I can think of lots of these despite not owning many of them, but I think most people know kind of dexterity games means obviously using your hands, I think, in some way to manipulate the game. Ta-da!
Very good definition. I don't think I can follow that really. I was going to say, it's probably the definition is obviously in the word dexterity, meaning, you know, using your hands. So it is about that. And there's a hand-eye coordination. It is obviously quite a different type of game usually. Mm-hmm. But it could be stacking, it could be balancing, it could be flicking, it could be otherwise moving. You're basically manipulating something with your hands. I mean, sort of classic things like Jenga. You know, those sort of games. That's the classic. I would say, you know, even foosball, those sort of games as well are dexterity games. You know, these are all the classics that maybe I've grown up as, you know, as a kid. But I can't really add anything to your definition. I think you've covered it all. Modern games, dexterity games that I think of are things like Catacombs and Castles. You know, that's adding a bit more ideas. So you're not just flicking wooden pieces on a board. You have obstructions as well, but you also then have cards that basically give that piece certain abilities. So, you know, you might be able to do a double attack, or you might be able to just move and then attack. So you have to do certain combinations of movements and things. So it adds a bit more level to the just the dexterity element. But you're right. I mean, it's quite a different beast of games to what we probably normally talk about. And I reckon they're underrepresented in this industry, really. There should be a lot more of them.
I think so, too. There's been a good few, I think, come out in recent years, or at least I've seen more of them. Maybe I'm just becoming more aware that they exist, because it's something I would never have occurred to me to think of for board games. I like your point about hand-eye coordination. I don't have any of that, which explains why I'm terrible at pretty much all of these. it's important stuff. But you're right, you're surprised there isn't more, especially with Jenga being so popular. I can't believe I didn't even think of Jenga or foosball, actually, for that reason.
I went straight
into modern board games.
Exactly. I thought I'd bring up the classics, but it's you know, those things, as I say, I think we've all grown up with them and probably not realized that we've been playing them, and you know, it's and maybe that's why they're not that popular, because they're sort of seen as sort of child games and party games that are, you know, usually frowned upon. And I don't think that's fair. I think there's, you know, a lot of fun in them. So
do you think we can actually talk about games and like ring toss, or as well as a dexterity game, or like darts?
Yeah, darts.
If we're going to go down the sports route, or games you can play on a lawn.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that leads into sports. I think they are dexterity games, really.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I suppose football is a dexterity game.
It is, really. I think I made the point in one of my articles about, I mean, it was supposed to be a bit of a half of a joke, but snooker is a tabletop dexterity game, really. You know, if you think about it, pool, snooker, and all those things.
You're really right. Like, how is that any different from something like, have you seen Clask?
Yep,
it's kind of like the something like that. Yeah,
same,
the little magnetic board, and you move the things around. Like, how is that any different from snooker, really?
Or air hockey, it's the same sort of idea.
Yeah, exactly. I'm watching tabletop games on TV with Jimmy White.
Exactly.
You know, interesting.
I think that should be included, but anyway.
Okay, so what has Board Game Geek got to say? Let's see what it says it actually is, and will it include snooker?
Yeah, well, I don't think it does, but the official definition, and there weren't any examples of games, but they're basically saying action / dexterity games, so they're obviously including the idea of action as well. They often compete players' physical reflexes and coordination as a determinant of overall success.
I don't know if I agree with that, because you can win a lot of these games without any skill or coordination. Sometimes you can just luck into physical things. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you've played any of those flicking games, like I can't flick, I can't aim, but you can randomly, you know, hit the thing you want to. Or the other one we forgot about, flick them up. There we go. Flick them up, you know, where you have to actually aim at things. I wonder, like, can you randomly, you can look into these kind of victories.
I think they certainly have a certain luck element in there. And again, there's also then some games that include some strategy elements as well. So it's not just then necessarily about dexterity, but you can also say old smart people. So that, you know, I think Catacombs and Castles has some of that idea of there. You might be really good at hitting the target, but if you don't have the right, you know, characters there with the right ability, you know, someone can still outsmart you. So I don't think it is just the only determinant. I wrote down a little fun fact. Apparently there is a unique word game called Dexterity.
So
you're supposed to, what does it say, your ability to form interesting, unique and provocative words and play intelligently is highlighted here. So I don't know what, I've not heard of this game, but I thought that's interesting that there's a word game that's called Dexterity. But I guess using your brain in a sort of way, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's dexterity. Like, in that sense, you're talking about dexterity with language. Yeah. So maybe being able to think the box and stuff like that. And with dexterity games, you often do have to do that, because it's not always a straight, it's flicking at something. Like, for instance, especially with the stacking games, you have to tactically decide where it goes, or come up with a unique way to approach it. So dexterity word game, this is interesting.
So I'll bring that in there.
Is it available?
We'll see if you still see if we can buy it. I haven't looked that up yet, so we'll have to check that out.
Exactly. Okay, that was cool. That's dexterity. I really do like dexterity games. I really wish I had more of them. I think they're just so much fun.
They are,
I think you kind of want a good couple of people to play them with you to really make them fun. You know, where everybody's failing at something miserably, way more entertaining.
Exactly.
So the second definition then, we'll get to this, and this is one of my favorite phrases to hear about board games, is tableau building. So, Oliver, what do you think tableau building is?
Right, tableau. Yeah, see, that's interesting. I immediately was reminded of like deck building games. I think there's a similar sort of idea that you basically have a set of, well, I guess this time we're talking about more tiles than cards, but as far as I understand it, you basically again sort of build your tableau up, you know, again usually spending, you know, I don't know, some sort of money or some sort of resource or something like that. But to be honest, I don't know whether I've actually come across tableau building games that much. I mean, I'm probably going to be shown off, because there's probably loads that I have played and just haven't connected that with tableau building.
Yeah.
So I think I better stop there and see what your definition is, because I'm not too sure.
The first thing I'm going to tell you is that you've mentioned the game today that's a good tableau builder, and that's Wingspan, because you lay the cards out in front of you,
okay,
and you build your engine. But so there you go. Yeah. So you are familiar, but I agree it's an awkward kind of term, because it's kind of broad. So this is what I came up with. So a game which has you lay out components, often cards, in front of you that you control or can use, that can represent your game board. So sometimes you don't have a game board, but you'll have a set of cards that you can activate.
Okay.
Oftentimes the objective is to create an efficient tableau to help you meet the game's victory conditions.
Right.
So that's where I was going. So yeah, Wingspan is a good example of
that.
That's
a good example, definitely. Yeah.
The combination, of the right cards together to get a good kind of outcome. A couple of ones that I thought of when I thought about it, I thought of many, but I'll roll off something like Race for the Galaxy. If you've ever played that. So
I haven't, but I'm aware of it. Yeah.
Yeah, you lay them out in front of you. Space is another one as well. But this, you get your own board, but you build your tableau into it.
Yeah.
With other spaceships. Obsession is one where you use tiles. Actually, you build up your house in front of you, and all the tiles are your rooms and they do different things. And then just to be fancy, I'll mention Bruges, because I really love that game. And that's where you basically use your cards as houses in front of you, and then you put people into the houses as well. And so these are all games without player boards, but where you lay stuff out in front of you that you can activate. So that's what I consider tableau building. Yeah.
I think, I mean, That all makes sense. And as I say, I don't think I've actually played that many tableau building games. I can't think of Wingspan. I've played is Le Havre, I suppose, is a sort of tableau builder as well to some degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely, because you put those pieces in front of you as you buy the buildings and stuff. Yeah.
So, and then, I'm just trying to think. Maybe Bremerhaven is another one potentially. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just, as I say, I haven't ever made a connection with that term as a tableau builder. Yeah. But
another one I know you know is Oaxaca.
Yes.
If I can pronounce it correctly, Oaxaca. Oaxaca. Yeah, Oaxaca, thank you. You have it right. You can be the linguist of the show.
Thank you.
So that's another one. You lay your, you know, you have your things you buy and you put them out in front of you. So maybe there's more of them in your life that you just didn't know.
Just
about.
Didn't think of them that way. I guess I'm thinking of those games more like an action selection type game. But yeah, they are more tableau building. Absolutely right.
No, but you're very right, because your tableau is things you can use. So it is very much action selection. It's just there your personal one, isn't it? So, yeah. Okay. So will we go for the definition?
So what has BGG said? Shall I read that out again as well?
Go for it. Yeah, why not?
So
you're doing such a good job.
Thank you. I'm good at reading. In tableau building games, each player has a visible personal array or tableau of components, as that's what you said, cards, tiles, player boards, etc., which they purposefully build or manipulate throughout the game by spending actions or resources, including opportunity costs, whatever that may mean specifically, and which determines the quality, quantity, and or variety of actions to which they have access throughout the game. The array is not merely a place to store resources, this is a long definition, to plan out actions, to store a puzzle which must be manipulated, or something that impacts victory points. It impacts the quality, quantity, and a variety of actions which are accessible to a player. This means that some games may include an array or tableau, but not really be a tableau building game. So there we go. That that's that. So yeah,
I like the first part of that. I'm feeling very proud of myself right now with my Friday morning work ethic.
I think you got it spot on, to be honest. Yeah, so you covered all the points.
I do play a lot of them, to be fair. I like Tableau building. I like having your own kind of personal stuff in front of you that you use and things like that. You do get some interesting situations though, where you have games where you build a Tableau and other people can use things in your Tableau.
Yes. Yeah. Just, a key flow or something like that, or key flower.
Yeah, where people can use your things. It's very mean. But yeah, but I think for the most part that makes sense. I think it's quite a popular type of game, isn't it? Tableau building, now that we kind of...
Well, apparently so. I've never thought about it that way, but yeah. As I find out, more people... There's more games than I'd realized.
Your homework is to go look at your collection and come back with a list of Tableau builders you secretly own.
For next episode, okay. I'll make sure. That leads us to our last term, bluffing. Do you want to talk about bluffing games?
Okay, I'll talk about bluffing. Here we go. So bluffing games ask you to deceive others or misconstrue the truth to other players for your own or a team's benefit. You don't have to lie. Omissions often work, and it's mostly used in larger group games.
Very good. Wow. Yes.
You think I've done this before?
You definitely have prepared for this one.
It's something I should be good at with all my years of philosophy, is defining things and shrinking things into single sentences. Yeah. So I'm glad
you have the background
good.
There. You have the experience. Yeah, the...
I'm glad all those years paid off. Brilliant. So
I was going to say, I don't know how much I can add to that. I was going to say that they're usually also classified as social deduction games, because that usually includes... Oh, yeah. Bluffing. I mean, bluffing is a part of social deduction games usually. So social deduction is maybe a bit more about actually working out who people are and what they do. But bluffing obviously is an element. So you, as I say, you pretend to not have that information, or you offer different information depending on what the rules allow, whether you can actually outright lie or whether you just have to be quite clever. And to be honest, I think bluffing is quite often, I think, used in sort of heavier games as well, not necessarily as a mechanism as part of the rules, but obviously if you have a certain strategy in your game and you don't want other players to realize what you're doing, you might be, you know, misdirecting people and say, oh, look over here, and, you know, why don't you build your building over there and things like that. So I think bluffing works throughout games, not necessarily as in, you know, in the sense of bluffing games, but, you know, I think we use it probably in bigger games groups, as you say, when they have more people, quite a lot throughout without realizing necessarily.
That's really interesting. That was such an alpha gamer thought you had about bluffing to your advantage in like more complex games. I'm like, oh God, yes. That's how people are really thinking approach the game, because they know everything that's going on.
But to be fair, when we play, I'm always quite transparent. I don't bluff, but I find a lot of other players do bluff. And I'd never actually thought about that until I realized halfway through, oh, hang on, they're actually intentionally not saying something or saying something else because they don't want me to think about that. But as I say, in our games group, definitely there's players who do that. They wouldn't necessarily outright lie, obviously, but they might, you know, not respond, or, you know, sort of, you know, indicate something else so that they misdirect you in a different direction.
That's interesting. I wonder as well then, on that vein of thought, so there are games where let's say you've hidden information, and I mean that in the sense of, I'm going to think of some real classic, like acquire, so people buy shares in buildings, and you don't necessarily have to tell each other the number of shares you got.
Yeah.
So you can't, so keep, like, you know, that kind of secret information. I wonder, can you bluff in those kind of games too, letting on you have more of something than you have, or you've less of something?
Definitely, yeah. And I mean, I suppose bidding games as well, you know, they're quite often about bluffing. You know, you might bid up someone, not actually intending to win the bid, but you're bluffing to, you know, try and make them spend more money than they, you know, they, that's really worth. You know, so as I say, I think bluffing games as such are a category, but I think there's bluffing happening throughout a lot of games that, you know, without we necessarily thinking about
it. Really clever. It's really good. I don't actually own many bluffing games, because they're the kind of games normally you need to have a lot of people for, and I just don't have it. I do have two that come to mind. Well, I only own two, as it turned out. So one of which is called Celestia. So this is the game where you're trying to get as far along in the row as possible as the captain of the ship and try to convince everyone else to jump off along the way.
Okay.
And it's the kind of game that breaks relationships.
Yeah.
Because you have to lie to people's faces or pretend you're not lying. So it's a fun kind of bluffing game. And then the one I think that most people are aware of is Spyfall, which is a very strange kind of bluffing game because you have to bluff without really knowing what's happening. Like Spyfall, I think, is the most complicated game in the world to explain. I'll never forget trying to learn it. It was the most difficult thing. Have you played it?
No, I haven't.
So basically the idea is that there's a whole group of you and one of you is an outsider. And the main group all get cards or locations telling them where they are and what kind of job they're doing. And the outsider doesn't know.
Okay.
So you proceed to ask each other questions to figure out, is this person aware of where we are together? Or do they not know where we are?
Okay.
And the outsider's job is to try and figure out where everybody is without being figured out first. It's a really strange one to explain.
Okay, that makes sense.
There's a lot of bluffing in that. And also not just bluffing, but kind of side talking, I want to say, where you're trying to talk around a particular issue without having to be direct. Yeah. Maybe it isn't bluffing. Think about it, but I think it is because you have to pretend and avoid the truth or find out the truth.
Well, that's bluffing, definitely. Maybe.
What about yourself? Have you got a better range to choose from than I do?
I don't think I really play bluffing games. The only two, well, one that I think is a definite is Coup, and I've played it a few times, and that taught me I'm no good at bluffing. And there's lots of other players who are really good at it. Because I think a lot of bluffing games also require you to remember what people have, you know, cards have played or things have said in the past. And I don't really like memory games because I guess my memory isn't that good. I don't know. But I found with Coup, I'm trying to bluff and I don't think I normally get away with it. Usually because I, you know, pretend to have a certain card that I quite clearly can't have because it's physically impossible in the game or something like that, given, you know, the game state. So I would avoid them, I suppose. But the other one that I do love playing is Love Letter. And I don't know whether it's specifically a bluffing game because really you can't lie in this game. You have to be honest. So, you know, there is no lying whatsoever. But at the same time, there are situations, depending on what card you play, you can try and misdirect someone. So I don't know. Have you played Love Letter before?
I have played Love Letter before.
And I mean, you have situations, for example, the classic moment when you have the Countess. Mm-hmm. Normally you have to play the Countess if you have the Prince or the King. And obviously if the Princess, you play the Countess. But our daughter developed that strategy of playing the Countess, even though she had like a really low card, because then we suddenly thought, oh, hang on, she must have the Prince or the King or even the Princess. So, you know, next time you have a guard, you might guess those things while she was holding onto Handmaid or something like that. So there is, even in that game, I think there's a fair amount of bluffing actually happening if you play to that level. Once you've played a few more times and you know how it works, you know, intentionally playing a card that people think you got the other card you've capped is a certain card. So I don't think people would necessarily call it a bluffing game, but there's certainly bluffing going on. But that's the only other game that I enjoy playing. But other than that, I'm no good at bluffing, really.
I like that example. It's really kind of like a fake out, you know, a kind of bluffing or, you know, there's quite a few games actually now that I think about it do that kind of thing where I'm playing this card to make you believe that I might have this other one to go with it. You know, they're usually in closed games where there's only a certain amount of cards each of you have and you know each other's cards, you know, and you're pretending, you know, what might come next. That's a really interesting type of bluffing, actually. It's one you don't see that often in games. I think it's really interesting, though, when you're trying to outsmart your opponent like that.
I want to play more of those sort of games where we have that strategy. And basically, I mean, even in open information games where basically everything is on the table and you could work it out, but there's, you know, I guess there has to be some element of hidden information. But even if you're just trying to basically, you know, make someone believe you're following a certain strategy when you're actually doing something else, because, you know, the next turn, you know, you have something ready to do. And I want to play more of those sort of games as well, you know, where you have a strategy that could actually be quite obvious, but you're trying to misdirect the other player so that you can follow that through. You know, I quite like that element, even though, as I say, I don't know how good I am at those sort of things, but it's certainly an element.
I'm terrible at those sort of games, actually. The one I can think of actually is a two-player only game, and it's called Battlecon, and it's basically like playing Street Fighter. You both have a hand of set cards that are identical, and you have your own special ones for each character, but your opponent gets to all of your cards as you play, so they're like, you know what's available in their hand and what they've already used, so you're trying to work out, well, they can play this one this round and do this, or they might do this, and then you're trying to play the counter cards to work it out. It's head wracking is probably the best way to put it. Like, I can't think ahead very far, but it is super clever in that idea of trying to work out what your opponent might possibly be playing, or you can also, you know, you can fake things too. This is actually bluffing's gone a lot broader than I thought.
The one game that might explain a bit further what I was saying earlier about actually open information games, where strategy is important and bluffing is also important, is in a game like Scythe, for example, where literally everything is on the board. Everyone can see where your figures are, everyone can see how much money you've got, you know, all resources and things, yet you might be moving in a certain direction, making someone think. And again, it's a big element in Scythe is the threat of attack when you're not actually attacking. So you might move towards someone, they might think you're about to attack them, but actually you're just trying to move into a certain hex to then gain resources that you need and things like that. So those sort of games are quite a joy, where, you know, the information is all there, so you could work it out, but you have to cleverly move and do certain things in an order so it's not obvious what you're aiming for. And I quite like that sort of element of things.
Yeah, that's a good choice. What did the definition say?
Board Game Geek says, bluffing games encourage players to use deception to achieve their aims. All bluffing games have an element of hidden information in them. So, basically what we've been saying.
Yeah, we're good at this.
Yeah.
Very good. Actually, I didn't realize I enjoyed bluffing games that much till we talked about them.
Yeah.
To be fair, they're in a lot more things than I had thought. I think there's quite a couple of unique ways to use bluffing, other than, you know, pretend you don't have a particular card in your hand.
Yeah.
You know? That's pretty cool.
No, because there's more to it than just outright lying. It's much more subtle than that.
Excellent. So are we ready for our big conversation of the month, I think? Of the month? Of this episode?
Yeah, this episode, I think it's about once a month, isn't it now? So, let's move to the big topic. So moving on to the big topic of this episode, small box game. I said big topic for small box games. So you see what I did there? Hey,
you're so smart. Jokes.
Moving on swiftly. So let me just define roughly what I mean by small box games, because I'm sure some people will define it slightly differently. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but I just want to sort of frame our conversation a little bit. And what I've written down is basically a game that comes in a box that is small enough to easily take with you in a small bag or by stashing in a rucksack, or even a game that fits into your coat pocket. So we're not talking about, I mean, I don't know, there isn't this sort of size limit as such, but I'm sure there's, you know, everyone will understand, you know, can you easily take that with you? Or do you have to, like, you know, get a bag to put your game in? You know, does it fit like into the side pocket of a rucksack, or is there, you know, a little bit of room in the top of your rucksack? Can you squeeze in that game? And that sort of size I'm thinking of. Also, what I want to exclude is things like postcard or letter games. They are, to me, another group of games where literally, and I think they're quite popular. Maybe we should do another topic, but, you know, where you basically subscribe, and I think there's even Patreons for them, where you subscribe for like £1 a month and you get a postcard or a little letter in the post once a month, and it's got a little game in it. It's nothing going to be amazing, but again, some of those ideas are amazing. But to me, the reason why I want to talk about small box games, because it does obviously create certain restrictions purely because of the size. And people sometimes underestimate them.
Okay, interesting. Because my first question obviously is how small is small. So you're talking in carry size. Like, for instance, you could take Carcassonne out of its box and carry the tiles in a bag. You know, but I don't think that constitutes a small box game, does it?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, technically Carcassonne isn't, and in fact there's obviously Carcassonne the big box, which is giant. But I'm proud to say I have actually taken Carcassonne the big box out and put it into a small like plastic box. Obviously, you have to remove some components, like, you know, school boards and things. You might have to print out your own and maybe remove some bits. I think in the Carcassonne big box edition, we've got this, like the Wheel of Fortune. We've got the German, I think that's what it translates at. And that board is basically too big. But if you print out your own little scoreboard and things like that, you can easily stash that away. And then, yeah, it becomes a small box game. But technically speaking, no, Carcassonne isn't in itself a small box. So we're literally talking about games that you know, come in a box. Saying that, though, you know, you get some games which are literally like a deck of cards. They come in this giant box, take it out. And to me, that probably is a small box game, really. Okay. So there is a bit of a gray area, definitely.
Okay, so I suppose, you know, what's the appeal of a small box game? Because I'm not sure I fully understand it, because normally when you think of buying a board game, you get, you know, those Ticket to Ride size boxes to go on your shelves. You know, why would, you know, what's so appealing about them? What's, you know, what makes them different from regular games? You know, why have they their own category?
Yeah, what I find interesting about them, because, yeah, normally people say the bigger the better, you know, big shiny box, big Gloomhaven box, giant, you know, with lots of miniatures and, you know, heavy and super table presence. And I absolutely get that. I mean, I love shiny games as well. I mean, I love Rising Sun. That looks absolutely gorgeous on the table with all those miniatures and things. And it's great fun to play. But small box games, I think, are interesting because they create quite a big design constraint, purely physically the size. Trying to fit something into a small box does limit what components you can have in there and what are the size of the components. And trying to get that right to make a game that is actually still playable, first of all, I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily complex or anything, but just something that you can actually play as a game is quite difficult. You know, the obvious thing people think of probably is things like card games. You know, just a normal deck of card is just a small box game, really, and you can play lots of different games with a deck of cards. But going for things in something like The Mind, that's a small box game, and that already adds another level of gameplay and mechanisms and things, and makes it a lot more interesting, I think, you know, having that player interaction. You can obviously then go smaller to things like Mint Tin games that are even smaller, Mint Tin mini games smaller yet, and yet these games can be really quite interesting. And And a lot of people, I think they're just light, fun, sort of party-level games. Yeah. There's not much strategy behind them. But you'd be surprised how actually complex some of these games are. So, and that's what I think makes them a separate category. There's even competitions for, like, Minton games. I think they've sort of started. Well, the earliest I could find was a reference to 2015. They've probably been going for longer. But, you know, Minton design competitions have been around for a long time, because it is a limitation that it's actually quite hard to fit a game into. So if you can meet that, you have to be quite clever.
I wonder why people choose to put that limitation on themselves, because obviously having to compact things into a smaller box for start changes how a game works, or gives you less room, I think, to really kind of expand your game or explore your game. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but does a small box mean a less intricate game? Can you still have a complex game with components?
Absolutely, I think you can. And I think there's games, I mean, there's games like, I'm thinking Microbrew, for example, from One Free Elephant, that is actually quite a complex strategy game. I mean, there's a fair amount of luck, but just moving the pieces around on so you've got your, I don't know whether you've played or whether you know it, but you basically have your little brew kettle and you've got walls in there and you have to sort of shift them around, but they can only shift in a certain direction, and you're trying to make patterns to fit a certain recipe that you then brew and things. So there's quite a lot of mechanisms in the small box, and there's lots of components in there. And I know Monfrey Elephant are very proud of having fitted all these tiny components into there. And I know people have complained that game is a bit fiddly, but I played it and I enjoyed, and I can see why it's fiddly. But again, it's perfect. It fits in a mint tin. There's loads of components and there's loads of mechanisms in there, and there's lots of thinking in there. It's not just a matter of rolling a few dice or playing some cards and, you know, hoping for the best and it's a bit of a laugh. It is actually quite a lot of strategy in there and lots of thinking. So there is certainly an element in there that the size doesn't necessarily mean it's a lesser game. And quite the contrary, especially if you think of card games. I think, you know, coming from Germany, card games are sort of tradition. You know, I grew up with playing card games, and a lot of them are actually quite complex, abstract games. You know, I would say the sort of strategy elements in there are comparable to games like chess, and it's just a deck of cards. So you can see that you can create quite complex games in a small box.
interesting. All right. So I haven't played as many small, I haven't played as many small box games as you. That's why I'm interrogating you about the topic. Just because I suppose it's something I'm curious about, but I haven't reached, you know, all the way into. I've come across a couple in my time, but are small box games always short ones? Like, have we come across, you know, a small box game that, you know, is like 90 minutes? Are they always kind of quicker?
No, not necessarily. I think that's so important to talk about this topic, because it is all about this sort of perception of, oh, it's a small box, so it must be. Especially recently, as I say, a lot of people say, oh, the bigger the box, the better. But these small box games, no, they can last a while. I'm trying to think, Microbrew probably takes probably about 45, 60 minutes or so, depending on how quickly you play it. Apparently, you can actually buy two mint tins off Microbrew and play them like three or four player as well. So there's a way of expanding that, and I think that's quite clever. The game length isn't defined by it, and I think that what makes it so interesting. I mean, of course, there will be plenty of mint tin games out there that are literally just a matter of rolling a few dice, having a laugh, you know, so playing it for 5, 10, 15 minutes, game's over, and you play another game. And again, I think that's actually quite attractive about some of them. And I think I've mentioned quite a few times now Subquark and the Mint Tin games that, you know, Dave and Kate produce, and that are great fun. They're not necessarily complex or difficult, but they're ideal. You take them with you. We've played them in restaurants or pubs many times while we're waiting for food. They don't take up much room. I think that's the other advantage of the small box games. Usually they're easy to carry, but also don't take up much table presence. So you can play them in, you know, on a train or on a plane, even potentially. I mean, I've not tried that, but certainly if you have a table in a train or something like that, you can play them there in a, you know, in a pub or restaurant. And yes, usually they are quite quick, but not necessarily. Okay. The game length isn't determined, so it goes both ways.
Okay, that's kind of it's kind of interesting actually, because I haven't played many myself. I've played Dice of Pirates from Thing 12 Games, and I had a lot of fun with that. It came with a tiny ship in the tin. I was like, wow. And yeah, it's amazing what they fit in, and it's a rolling dice game. But there was a very, very clever mechanism to how you roll the dice, and I thought it was super smart, considering, you know, how little game there is, but so much game at the same time. And it got me thinking, you know, what kind of advantages do you have with a small box? There's got to be, you know, a bunch of positives to it, you know, that people probably don't think about.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, when you buy games these days, quite often it's all about presentation in a shop. So you get as we mentioned before, you get a deck of cards basically in a bigger box just so it looks nice in a shop and, you know, gets attention. And that's almost a shame. I quite like, you know, if it's a deck of cards, it should just be a small box. If it's, you know, a few dice and a few pieces, why do you stick it into a bigger box to make it look bigger than it actually is? And, you know, as I say, I've repackaged games before. I've even repackaged King of New York into a smaller box. So that can actually fit as well. Again, we had to reprint the map to make it fit. But I wouldn't necessarily say we were able to put it in a small box. It's probably still a bit too big to easily carry around, but you certainly can. It's, as I say, the advantage of the small box games is physically the size. So being able to quickly stash a game, you know, take it with you. So you might, you know, have games night, you take a couple of bigger games, and then you still have room for a handful of smaller games quite easily. And sorry if I keep quoting One Free Elephant, but I think as far as I've heard, they've made a video of where they fit the Microbrew game into the Gloomhaven box, but with all the Gloomhaven components still in it. And I think they've got like 15 mint tins into that space. So it, you know, it shows you can actually take quite a few different games, you know, that size, and take them with you. And, you know, say if you go to games night, you have then a selection of games you can play as maybe as a starter game or as a game at the end, if it is a quicker game, or even as a main game if you have something that is a bit more involved. I mean, other examples of games that maybe take a bit longer are obviously the Mint Works sort of selection of, you know, the 525 apps. Games, you know, Mint Delivery, Mint Cooperative, I think is their latest now. So again, they are, you know, have more strategy and take a bit longer to play. So you can just have the space. And purely, I mean, I carry around with me, and maybe that's quite sad, but I do have Mint Tin Mini Skullduggery and Mint Tin Mini Apocalypse from Subquark with me virtually all the time. So if you see me in the street and want to play a game of those, say hello. As I say, it's the size is obviously the big bonus, but also, quite often these games, again, not necessarily, but a few of them are quite easy to explain. So quite quick to learn, quick to teach. And then those games that are like that are usually also quite quick to play and don't take up much table presence is the main thing for all of them. They're all of them, even though they're you know, in a small box, which is great for carrying, but actually the table presence as well. So if you do want to play them while you're out and about, you know, on a picnic table, wherever, it's absolutely spot on. You know, you can't take Gloomhaven with you on a bus or on a train journey. So
I wouldn't want to try. I think the other thing, that's actually really interesting about the small box games is they're, I think they're very good for new players. As you said, you know, the rules are normally fairly easy to understand, but also because of their price, they don't cost the same as a big box game. And I think it's a great entry for people into board gaming who don't want to invest a ton of money, but still want to actually play, you know, full games. So I'm surprised they aren't marketed that way more. They seem to be this kind of niche thing at the minute. If you're into the, tin games, then, you know, you want them all. You're standing on the edges wondering what all the fuss is about. I do think there's something very appealing about a game in a tin. I'll say that, as opposed to like boxes. Very few games come in tins. Like the other one I can think of is Forbidden Island comes in a tin, and it's a game, but the little games are really interesting. They're also really cute, and I've got to think that they got to be good, you know, when it comes to storage. You know, thinking for the size of one game, you could store 50.
Exactly. That's another reason why I love them so much, because, you know, my cupboard space is limited. So they fit in a drawer quite easily. You can have like 10 games in a drawer, no problem.
Fantastic. Do you miss out though on things like artwork and stuff like that when the game is so small? Because normally, I'm just guessing here. From my own experience is that when you open the tin and stuff, it's usually there's a lot of components, but you don't always get cards or things like that with things to look at. It's all based on the little physical things for the game. How do you find that?
You don't have a big box with lovely artwork on the box, of course. That goes out of the window. But obviously with things like card games, they can, you know, be beautifully illustrated. I mean, if you think of games, and I would include those in small box games, are things like, you know, Flux from Looney Labs or Citadels from Z-Man Games, all the sort of gaming games, tiny epic boxes, I'd consider still as small box games. And if you've played any of those games, you know, with a mind, okay, maybe the illustrations are quite basic, but if you look at something like Citadels, it's actually beautifully illustrated. So you get, you know, actually quite a lot of beautiful artwork in there. And depending on the version you get of Citadels, you get lovely plastic coins and things as well. You know, so there is some tactile part of it as well. And obviously, certainly with a tiny epic range of games, the little meeples you get, and you have, you know, can attach weapons and things, you get something actually that looks beautiful on the table as well, and quite often the boxes are used as well, so you're actually using every millimeter, every inch of space that you have in the box, and every component has to count, basically, you know, has to work twice as hard to create a really interesting game. So no, you obviously, so the table presence is different, but it isn't necessarily worse. And again, I'm thinking of the Subquark games. And again, he's a patron, so maybe I should just as a disclaimer. But Mintin Skullduggery, you know, the little skulls are in there that are little beads, basically. They're just, you know, they're tiny, but they're highly detailed and they're gorgeous. And some games have little coins with them, and they even come with like little meeples and things. So it isn't necessarily a worse game or a less beautiful game just because it comes in a mint tin. And in fact, as I was just saying, all of these components have to work a lot harder, because you can't just add, you know, a few more components to just add this little extra expansion or this different mechanism. Everything has to fit, and everything has to work really hard to create a really good game.
That's true. Actually, you just made me think there, because I was wondering about artwork in small box games. You mentioned Love Letter earlier, and that's, I would consider that to be very fairly small, but and of course you can, it's lovely artwork in all the 50 million different versions of Love Letter that are now available. But we've been talking a lot about the tins, but they're, I suppose, like card games and stuff are small box games too.
Definitely
something I can connect with, in the fact that I used to play Magic the Gathering for a number of years, or maybe you could think about Keyforge as well, where it's something that you can have a deck in your bag, or maybe two, and you can go and meet somebody and sit down and play. And it's interesting as well, I suppose, because they have quite, card games tend to have quite a table presence, you know, when they're spread out in their tableau. and whatnot, in a way that I think some of the tin games are different again. So there's a big, considering they're both small box games. They're very different, aren't they?
No, definitely. I think that there is a wide variety. And as I say, I think people possibly think of the small box games as sort of gateway games mostly, because a lot of them are, or certainly have been, you know, thinking of Love Letter. I mean, even thinking, as you said, Keyforge and Star Realms and all of the card games, that they tend to be, you know, quite simple to teach, you know, not very many mechanisms or rules to learn. Yet they do create quite a lot of player interaction and well, not in a negative way, but, you know, lots of gameplay and interesting strategies and things. So they certainly do lots of different things. And there's a huge variety, definitely. It's as I say, I think people don't realize that they're out there, as you say. It is a shame. You know, you were saying about the price point as well, that they are cheaper. And in fact, that can actually be another design constraint for the designer. So it's not just the size, trying to think, okay, what can I actually fit into this box, but also how can I make sure that the components and everything else, the production, fits into the price point as well, and still creating something that is actually quite interesting. I think that's why a lot of small box games are card games, because they're usually easier to produce, not that expensive. Okay, you obviously have to pay for artwork and there's costs in there, but usually they're more straightforward because a deck of cards is something that's quite standard and you can print even with your custom artwork. Whereas things like, you know, the microbrews and the Tiny Epic games and the Subguard games, you know, they have lots of components in there that are different and they're quite often custom and things like that. So trying to create something that actually still makes you, well, enough money maybe to break even. I don't think a lot of these people are very rich making lots of money off this, even if they're so successful. But as I say, then you get, you know, like success stories. I think like Mintworks has been a huge success. Mm-hmm. They even ended up having to reprint it. Uh-huh. And as I say, the Tiny Epic series, I think, of games has become quite popular as well. So they're certainly becoming more and more popular. But it's that sort of constraint that the size and the price point, everything creates, that I find fascinating how designers and developers solve those problems and come up with amazing games and amazing gameplay.
I wonder, actually, is the low price sometimes a detriment to the smaller games, because people don't feel like they're getting as much of a game when you pay less for something. You know, although then again, people would be very suspicious if they were, you know, charging, you know, regular box prices for small games. But I do think it's something that people question, that by paying less, I'm not getting as much of a game here, that there's, you know, I think that's a prejudice that might go against the smaller games. Like another example is the Wallet games from Button Shy Games. Things like Sprawl and stuff like that. Like a game so small it fits in your wallet, you know, it sounds really cool. But there's something about that instantly, I think, shifts your perception of board game comes in a box and it's got all this stuff. It takes, like, you know, however long to play it. And pairing it back like that is a different type of game. And I'm not sure people really appreciate it just yet. Because as you say, there is a skill in creating these type of games. Like, can you imagine if you're writing an entire novel and then they want you to actually make it fit in like a page?
Exactly.
You know, it's essentially what you're having to do here. And I hope people's perceptions change. The one thing actually that I think comes up a bit, and it's something I meant to think about more myself, is that are a lot of the smaller games good for solo play? I was trying to think which one of the, and if any of the tin games you could play by yourself.
It's quite funny. I think small box games have the same, I'd call it a problem, as bigger box games. A lot of them don't necessarily come with solo games or solo versions of the game, but it is becoming more prevalent now, which I think is great. I was watching a Twitter conversation between Subquark, David Miller, and I can't remember who else, about offering a potential solo variant for their latest game. Because, you know, I think as a designer, creating solo games, again, is a different sort of skill set, which small box companies or designers and developers and publishers don't necessarily have, because they tend to be also smaller companies and smaller, you know, types of people. So, you know, having that happen more is great. But I mean, like Microbrew has certainly as a solo variant, but I think a lot of those smaller games lend themselves, as I say, for taking with you out and about, and probably are, you know, there to while the time with someone else. But as I'm saying that, I realize obviously a lot of solo players want exactly that, while away the time while they're out and about somewhere. So I think there is certainly an opportunity here to plug that gap and give solo players who, you know, are on the train commuting or whatever they might be doing, to while away the time with a game that they can just fit in their pocket and replay and enjoy. So there's certainly an opportunity in there, but as I said, I don't think there are that enough solo or enough games with solo variants in that category, like they are in the rest of the industry. That, you know, solo games seem to be, yeah, not really that much of a focus, but it's becoming more important. So it's great that's happening.
It seems like the ideal situation, really, where you have something you can carry around in your pocket that you could pull out and play. So like Sprawlopolis is a solo version, I know that. And of course, there's like Assembly as well. Literally just, you know, a deck of cards, really. You could bring that in your pocket and play that anywhere. So I think there's definitely something here to be said for a small game that you can take anywhere that you could play by yourself, really.
Yeah.
Although whether or not people would make the choice to either play a game on their phone, you know, the phone versions of board games, than to have the actual tin themselves. I don't really know. But it does seem like, I suppose, this is really funny because we're honing in on particular games we're familiar with. I'm sure there are tons more games we're just not even thinking about, you know, that we own and love. I suppose I have a good few card games and things like that. That's more up my street. But I'd never think about bringing them places. Oftentimes I like the smaller games because they are usually quicker. They usually have, I think, they have something, or maybe the ones I'll enjoy anyway, certainly have some sort of twist. So there'll be something fairly easy to do or understand, but there'll be one little thing that makes it really stand out, or makes it really interesting, or a tough choice or something like that you have to make. I suppose I have more small box games than I think I do. I think maybe most people do, but they don't all necessarily have to be kind of those introductory level games, right? That there can be so much more to this. I suppose I've got one final question for you. What would you recommend to someone trying a small box game for their first time? If you've never heard of this before today and you're like, oh, I'd like to try something out, what would you suggest?
Well, it's always a hard question because it obviously depends on who you are and who you're playing with and all that. Again, I think there's a huge variety. I mean, we'll try and put all the links in the description of this podcast as well to all the various games that we've come across. And it depends what you want. But if you just want to try something that's quite quick and easy and just fun to play, I definitely recommend you looking at Subquark games, the Mintin games. They're all fun, they're all a good laugh, and they don't take long, you know, take 15 minutes at the max to play. So they're ideal if you just literally just want to have something in your pocket you can take with you and just play with literally anyone. It takes 5 minutes to explain the rules of most of these games, and off you go and you play and you have fun. If you want something more complicated, then I'd probably look at things like the microbrews, the midworks types of games. I mean, Assembly obviously being the another more complex game. That should give you, you know, a good fun game, something you might want to play, you know, in the evening with your partner or with friends. They probably take a little bit more time to explain, but they're great fun. You know, I'm just thinking, if the reason why you want a small game is because you want to take it out and about with you and play with anyone. So Subquark games are probably the better match there. And then obviously a lot of those sort of card games, you know, the Star Realms, the Tiny, the Mind, Flux, Love Letter, Citadels, all those sort of games, you know, Coup even, they all, I think, fit that bill as well. They're quite easy to take with you and play with your friends in a pub because they don't take up much room because, you know, card games, a lot of them, you hold a lot of cards in your hand and the ones that are out don't usually take up much space. So as I say, it does depend. If you've never gone into that sort of realm of small box games, I highly recommend Subquark. They're just beautiful games, handmade games. You know, it's the whole backstory with it. Just go on their website and read how these games are made. They're just absolutely gorgeous and wonderful. So I love those.
I suppose, like, if I'm gonna recommend something, I don't own many small box games, but I do enjoy card games, and I'm very picky about what card games I like. But this is one that stands out, and I do think it's got a lot of ease to be able to bring it places. I like that definition of that your game should be mobile, like that you should be able to bring it with you to define it as a small box game. It's a really good choice. And I'm gonna go with Epic, the card game.
Oh yeah,
and this is kind of like any of those Magic the Gathering type games where you play cards from your hand, you've spells and creatures and whatnot. But the cool thing about it is that you only need, I think it's 30 cards for your deck, and you can pick cards up at random. You don't build a deck or anything. You literally just put a pile of cards next to you and you play them.
Okay.
And it's really straightforward. It's really fun because all of the title says it all. All of the cards in that you can play are amazing. Everything's brilliant. Epic. So you draw a new card, you're like, wow, look what I drew. And then your opponent does something ridiculous and you're like, is so unfair. And then you've something else. Everything in the game is indeed epic. The artwork is lovely, and it's a really fun little two-player card game. And I know it's the kind of thing, if I was going somewhere and I had some time to kill, I think that's the one I would bring with me. But yeah, I must look into some of these a little bit more. I'm still trying to get over the idea of, I've bought a board game that didn't come in a box, but it might just be the fact that I suppose I don't go out a whole lot, so I don't have a need to bring my games with me.
And a lot of gamers in the industry, they play it in like a games group or with a family or things like that. So they only think, oh, we're going to play it at the kitchen table. And that's absolutely fine. That works. And I understand that. I completely get that. But at the same time, once you get into the small box games, the amount of times I've literally taken the game out and we played it in the pub while we're waiting for food, or, taken on holiday with us and played it somewhere out and about. Certainly, depending on obviously what you do and who you're spending your time with, but I do think you find that it's quite enjoyable just to literally be out and about while you're waiting for something, or you're traveling from A to B, get the game out rather than get your iPhone out and listen to a podcast. Well, obviously listen to this podcast, or listen to the podcast and play a game. Right. And it's just, it's just fun. It's a different type, as I say, usually of gaming. It's not these sort of long 6-hour games that, you can spend the whole evening playing, but it's certainly worth trying.
Definitely. So there you go. You've got some things to go and look up and think about and see if you're interested. I think it's the kind of games that'll fit particular types of people, that'll fit really neatly into their lives and the way they approach and play games. Hopefully that's you, and you can go and check them out. I think that wraps up this
segment. I think it does, and I'd wrap up the podcast as well. So I hope everyone enjoyed listening to this, and I learned something from our definitions and the topic. And as always, I think all we really have to say at the end is, ask everyone, please subscribe to this podcast and review it and give us some stars if you're on Apple Podcasts, as it's now called, rather than iTunes. And and look, obviously, in the description for the links to Antoinette's pages and videos and my blog as well. There's all there. And other than that, obviously, if you're looking for this podcast, we're available anywhere. On Spotify, Stitcher, Buzzsprout, and Feedburner, and I don't know what else. There's all these things. And on, obviously, iTunes.
I heard we're on LinkedIn now.
And
we're everywhere.
We're literally everywhere now. So you should miss us. But check our description with all the links there in there. And obviously, all the games we talked about there, they're in there as well.
Yeah, perfect. So thanks for being here, everybody. And we look forward to the next episode.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.